highlighted 177. Lance?
So I'm wondering if we ought to consider an option here. There are some weaknesses with some of these measures, you know, when you think about assessment, some of these strike me as being check-the-box type measures. Another potential option is looking at the patient experience surveys, and we're going to talk about this later today. It's one of our topics. But what I'm seeing in some of these surveys, for example, the CAP surveys, is hospital survey asks patients, you know, was my pain controlled? And I'm seeing it's listed in the home health surgery survey. So I'm wondering if there might be an option here to actually focus on measures from the patient's perspective instead of the provider checking a box and saying, yeah, we assess pain. Just a thought.
So you're less in favor of the two assessment measures that we talked about? Great, thank you. Dana?
So my challenge as I look at these measures, and again, not to go back and restate some of the obvious that's already been brought up by the group, is that while many of these measures I think are good in terms of where they're focusing on the care setting and the patient population, it's, again, that lacking of measures that cross a broader, has a broader reach across the care continuum and across populations. If I think about the pediatric measure for PICU, good measure for the PICU, but what about the rest of the pediatric population, you know, within in the hospital setting or other? So that is my challenge there. As related to assessment of pain, again, I think we said that it's been stated that it's assessing the pain, but then what is the follow-up and the treatment and the management of pain? Again, from the standards of nursing practice and care perspective, routine that pain is assessed and that then pain is reassessed, particularly after pain medications are administered as well, and that is documented. So that is part of the care process from a nursing practice perspective, whether that would be in acute care, you know, outpatient or home health or other settings as well.
So, Dana, just trying to put this into perhaps a GAP program. If I could read back to you what I'm hearing, in the treatment of pain, we need assessment, treatment, reassessment as a cycle to be included in measurement. Okay. Amy?
I think Dana actually captured very well a lot of my feelings along with Lance. I have trouble with the measures as just being, yep, we assess the pain, you know, okay, great. I think we really need to get more at patient experience and was the pain controlled and was that pain control optimal. So I don't know. I mean, 177 kind of gets at outcomes. I know it's a very narrow setting, but I have trouble with the other ones, you know, if we're looking for a parsimonious kind of core measure set.
So in favor of 177 and not so hot on 342 and 420?
Yeah. With the understanding that we really need to broaden and measures for other settings of care. I mean,
okay.
I think it's important.
And this gap, or maybe not so much the gap, but coming back around to the patient experience of care component. Great.
Mm-hmm.
Mitchell?
Yeah, two things. Sean, did you say take the hospice to 1637, I think it was, off? Because I noticed we're not talking about it. That pain assessment and screening? I'm looking at the Excel file, I guess. The 1637 and 1634. I think the only thing, I didn't know if, no, I said keep them. I put 1634 and 37 in. Yeah. No. I brought them back in, or tried to.
And my other comment would be that I really agree with this. We shouldn't fool ourselves about assessment, right? So there's already a Joint Commission regulation in adult critical care, so there's assessment for pain with a scale, and we know that that doesn't lead always to best practice. So to me, the more important statement from this group is identifying the gap in measuring a treatment rather than just doing the same old thing by enforcing assessment, which doesn't lead to any kind of change in outcomes.
Okay. Nancy?
So, surprise, I'm going to agree with my colleagues across the table. And on this side of the table, I think we're headed in the right direction when we talk about bringing this more together. And I actually like the suggestion that we use a patient assessment of whether their pain is managed as the sort of outcome of interest that we're trying to change, and that we then may couple that with particular drill downs into specific areas where we know pain management is an issue that needs to be addressed, whether it's with, you know, orthopedic patients post-surgery, or it's with those with osteoarthritis or others. We target a few areas where we know, or cancer patients, if we target a few areas where we know this is a major issue, we can help move the field along by pushing on particular sets of patients, I think. So I like the combination of the patient assessment and then the particular measures that get at assessment and action to address that.
We've got a few more cards up, but just for those on the far end of the room, you have a spreadsheet that perhaps you can see. This end of the table, we're going to share binoculars as soon as we find them. But we're trying to pull up some of these other measures that Sean had highlighted, because they're probably worth your input. Anne-Marie?
Yeah, in terms of the other measures, 209, I think, is particularly nice in that it not only says that it's reassessed, but also that within 48 hours it's controlled. So it puts a little bit of a time frame around the expectation for dealing with the pain. And I think that's something to consider when you do measures like this, instead of just how does the patient feel, but some expectation that it be done relatively quickly. This is hospice care, so maybe there 48 hours is reasonable. But I think some getting more specific about it, the better. And then just also on opioids, I think we need to look at the abuse of opioids, but I think we also would be nice to have a measure for the appropriate use of opioids as well, because there's beginning to be a movement to get away from those altogether almost from pain management because of all the politics, and I think that that could be problematic for some patients for whom those drugs are really kind of useful. So I think that whole area is a big gap. I mean, what is opioid use? How do you monitor it? You know, what's appropriate, what isn't, and I think that that's a big gap area that has to be looked at in terms of measurements at all levels of care, inpatient, outpatient, et cetera.
Sean?
There we go. Sorry about that. I wanted to just reemphasize, I think, what Nancy said. She beat me to it, but I like that a lot, because I think that for most patient populations, the patient-based surveys that include pain are terrific. But I do think that there's a gap in those that people who are seriously ill, or those people basically who die, or those with dementia, those are the ones that fall out of the cracks of those patient-related surveys because they can't answer the questions. And those are probably the patients at highest risk. So that I actually think that makes a lot of sense to me, is that for those who can self-report, the patient surveys are terrific. But for those specialized populations, we probably should drill down on patient-specific measures that actually look at processes, be it the hospice measure, which I think is ideal, be it the palliative care measure, which is probably a way to go. And I think the best thing this group could do is what Mitchell said, which is identify this as a real key gap area. But that's how I'm beginning to think about it, and I like it a lot. I like what Nancy said a lot.
David?
I'm really thrilled by this discussion because we found a topic that brings us all together. And I just
wanted
to say...
Is that pain or narcotics?
I was actually... my card went up when Nancy was speaking, so I was just nodding my head saying, thank you, Nancy. And for, you know, for looking at this in a patient-centered way and taking the opportunity maybe to start actually getting patient-reported outcomes in this important area. I just really like the way this conversation is going. I hope we capture that.
Andrea?
I have a couple of questions about the pediatric PICU measures. I think is it definite that that's 342 and not 342 and 341? I'm not sure if those are properly delineated there. And then the corollary question that I have is around, have those been recently gone through some maintenance of endorsement and maybe not been endorsed? I don't know this for sure, but we have a sense that that those did not get continued endorsement, and I would be interested in the reasons for that. I think in general we tend to like these measures. I will also say that there's an NDNQI measure that's very similar that extends outside of the ICU, as I recall. I'm not sure that I exactly remember it, that is not endorsed. It's not one of the endorsed measures amongst the NDNQI set. I'm not sure about the reasons for that and whether that is something that we should be considering if we're looking for a broader thing. The other thing that I will say about these measures, that while I'm in favor of these types of measures, the burden of data collection for these kinds of measures is really quite extensive, and so the way that people typically resort to doing this is to have the nurses audit their own units, and that's also very helpful for them to understand their practice, but it means that the rigor of the data collection is often lacking. And so I'm not sure, big picture, if that plays into why these may or may not have been endorsed or what that looks like and what the nuances are there. So while I'm a big fan of these measures, I'm a big fan of using them, I'm not totally sure about the rigor and implementation, as well as what the controversies may or may not have been during the endorsement process.
All right. Thank you. Randy?
Thank you. I do like the hospice and palliative care measures here. This is one of their core functions, and I would expect, or at least hope, that they should do well in this. I would be more concerned with persons with advanced illness who are not in hospice or palliative care, which might represent a gap that it should be possible to address. It might be possible to identify a population with advanced illness, which would be difficult, or perhaps identify a population of decedents. So I think the bigger gap here is not those that are in hospice, but those with advanced illness that are not.
So just to be explicit, you're referring to the list that we have showing up?
Yes. Yeah, the list up here. These are core functions for a hospice. I would really, they should do well in this, and maybe you could identify a small number that would not. And that would be great, and these are very good measures. But still, despite the fact that hospice election has increased a great deal in the last 10 years, still the majority of persons with advanced illness are not in hospice. And I think a gap would be to look at how we're doing with those people.
Thank you, Tom.
In trying to create, thinking about this discussion, is trying to create balances. Just looking up the statistics here, that in teens and young adults, drug-related overdoses exceed the causes of death from motor vehicle accidents. If we limit the pain management right now to hospice, we've got a very appropriate set that should not cause the Secretary any political flack. But I think that if we take some of the others, which I like, but need to have the balance of how to prevent unintended consequences, then we're back to trying to generate new measures. So I would rather limit this right now to some specific unique settings and not those where there's potential for drug abuse.
Sean?
Yeah, I hear you, Tom, although, you know, that's been the argument for 30 years. And it's one of the major reasons that we still have an epidemic of untreated pain. And I think that, you know, we're facing two public health issues. One is untreated pain, and one is misuse of prescription medications. And there's still no data that suggests that, you know, increased prescribing for pain is feeding the other or vice versa. And I do think that we need to be politically savvy, but address this as a public health issue for pain, and recognize that the other issue needs to be addressed separately. But again, I'm not aware of any data that suggests that one is leading to the other.
Mitchell?
Yeah, I just want to second what Sean's saying. I don't think this committee really has to worry about increased
prescribing of pain medication in the hospital, especially in a hospice environment, leading to any kind of substance abuse. And in addition, most of the published data, especially in critical care, that shows strong protocols for narcotic prescribing shows a decrease in the amount, overall amount of narcotics prescribed. So I think the literature is pretty strong in supporting that.
Heidi, do you have some update on Andrew's question?
Sure, yes. So 341 and 342 just went through endorsement maintenance in the pulmonary project. Throughout the course of the project, 341 was actually folded into 342, so the initial was folded into the periodic. But for both measures, they did not provide reliability and validity testing data, and so that's why endorsement is actually recommended to be removed, going to the board in the next couple weeks. I can get into more details if you want, but that's very, since you're behind schedule, I think that's all fixed.
Can I ask, are you saying that it was recommended, and but the board saying?
So, no. So, during the course of the committee evaluation, they didn't have any data on reliability and validity, so they could not pass that measure on scientific accessibility.
So, you're suspect that 341 was folded in the 342, and 342 is being removed.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So what I have in just from our discussion is it seems that everyone has been in favor, or there's really been no opposition to 177, which is the one outcome measure. Also, I've not heard really any opposition to these posted hospice measures that we have, that we've identified a whole list of gap areas to consider, which we've got notes on. I won't try to reiterate them, but that this is an area of vital interest for everybody. And not so much consensus, kind of a split on the assessment. Some folks said they like the assessments, but a lot of low bar comments on assessments. So an excellent point. And so I'm hearing that to keep 177, to keep these three that are listed, and I'm taking that as our consensus opinion, and that we're kind of split on the assessments as being low bar measures, and we would like something of more quality. Is that a fair enough conclusion on the pain measure set? Barbara, could you mic so they can hear you?
I'm sorry, I think the consensus was that people like assessment, but they want assessment that has consequences, that has follow-up.
Kind of to Dana's point of assessment, treatment, reassessment? Yeah. So that's the gap that we would like filled with the assessment measures that are there. But, and then the comment about patient reported. So that sounds like a pretty good set of recommendations to move forward with. Okay, great. Well, let's move then to sepsis. Oh, I'm sorry, Andrea.
Sorry, I raised it late. I did have a question for Sean. Given the palliative nature of measure 1617, why that was not part of the set you recommended? This is patients treated with an opioid who are given a bowel regimen.
Oh, just because I missed it. I think it's critically important, but I always have trouble with, you know, a group that's not in the pain world thinking that's important. But, yeah, I think it's, like, the one thing that we could do that would be effective in terms of appropriate.
So I know we've kind of settled on something, but I would endorse that measure. It's a process measure, but there's a strong outcome-oriented link to that, so. I support that.
Yeah, I would support that too.
Do we have, just as a Heidi, a technical question on this, are we talking about 1617? Yeah. Is this in maintenance?
It was in the, if I remember right, I've lost access to our database, but it's in palliative. So Sean will remember.
Yeah, it was. It was just endorsed, Frank, in the last round on the palliative care steering committee.
And are these chronic patients or
anybody treated with an opioid? so it goes across the board, which is where it needs to be. It's actually the one measure that goes across the board everywhere.
Okay. Well, I, speaking as a surgeon, I would probably speak against it, but...
Unless, the measure is unless there's a contraindication, Frank. I mean, we talked about it. I mean, I can go through the specs, but I seem to recall that, you know, there were appropriate exclusions.
That would be the key. Yeah. I mean, if someone's had intestinal surgery, I don't want them on a bowel regimen.
Right, no, agreed.
So, speaking as a colon and rectal surgeon. Okay. Nancy.
So the care setting, clinician office, clinic, hospital, acute care facility, not hospice, not nursing home, not others? I mean, is there a reason to limit it? Because, Sean, you were talking about it as across.
Unfortunately, we're fighting access to the data set right now.
Yeah, I'm just reading from the paper. Sorry.
My I shouldn't quote, but my recollection was it was all settings, Nancy, but I shouldn't quote that without, I mean, that was...
Is there a reason not for it to be?
No.
Okay.
Okay. So we will include 1617 as well, looking at the nodding of heads around the table. All right. The next is sepsis. And again, we don't have a reactor group to this, but we have just a few short measures, one of which was addressed in our earlier discussion, and that's 0351. So the other two measures that are for your consideration are 304, late sepsis or meningitis, and very low birth weight neonates, risk adjusted from the Vermont Oxford Network. And the other is measure 500 as endorsed, severe sepsis and septic shock. It's a management bundle that comes from Henry Ford Hospital. The one, the neonate, is level of analysis. It's a hospital acute care outcome measure. And the Henry Ford severe sepsis is also a hospital acute care composite measure. So, Mitchell, is your card up?
So, I'm going to comment, obviously, on the adult sepsis fund. It's a simple set of measures, but I think it's important that we understand that there's almost no sepsis performance metrics anywhere. So this is a small step. There are obviously a lot of data that suggest that every hour delay in receiving antibiotics in the hospital if you have severe sepsis or septic shock increases your risk of mortality. The same thing has been shown to a certain extent with fluid resuscitation, and lactate as a risk assessment is a simple measure. So these are not great metrics, but they're the only metrics that have been proposed, and there are a fair amount of data behind them.
David?
Just to echo that, this is a pretty limited set that we have available to us. So,
can you get close to your mic so they can hear you?
I'm sorry. This is a pretty limited set that's presented here, but it's all we've got. So I think we should go with at least the two outcome measures. And probably the process measure, too. I don't quite understand number 500. Does this take into account present on admission or not? Because I wouldn't want to see us confusing patients arriving with sepsis from those who developed it in the hospital.
Yeah, this is a measure for identifying patients with sepsis either in the emergency department, on the wards, or in the intensive care unit.
So you're saying presenting
right.
With. So then, okay, so what I really wanted to say is we have a huge gap here. what we want is to deal with the incidence of hospital-acquired sepsis. We don't have a measure of that. So I propose that as the gap area that needs to be filled.
Okay. So, Randy, you agree. Richard?
Yeah, I want to speak in support. I agree with the previous comments. I wanted to mention that in our collaboratives,
we found sepsis as the number one cause of death in excess of expected, so it's a very important issue. I do think that the incidence of sepsis is very important to measure. I also think that we need to somehow both improve and monitor the early identification of sepsis, because it was the one critical factor that really reduced the sepsis rate. So that's a huge gap in trying to encourage and monitor early identification of sepsis.
Amy?
I think we do kind of have the two, and I think you mentioned this at the last meeting, Frank. You know, there's patients who come in and the early identification of the fact that they're showing up with something that's sepsis, and then there's the patients where something goes wrong in the course of care and sepsis develops. And so I think, you know, for that first set of patients, absolutely the early identification and the recognition and getting them on the right treatment path is very critical. For both, one of the things that I think we have as a gap is not measuring sepsis mortality, and it may be that it needs to be measured differently for the two kind of paths. But, you know, if the sepsis bundle from Henry Ford, I mean, if that's actual, I defer to the clinicians, evidence-based, these are really important things to do once you've identified that sepsis, I would be supportive of that, I guess. And I would be supportive of the other measures as well. But I do think we need kind of that mortality measure and that early identification, because if that doesn't happen, it's, you know, the rest kind of doesn't matter.
So first, just backtracking to the measures, I'm really hearing interest in all three of these measures, 304, 351, and 500. And then to the gap, what I'm hearing is for community-acquired sepsis, we want early detection and treatment. And for iatrogenic-acquired sepsis, we again want early identification, treatment, rescue, and or mortality.
The rate of incidence of those.
Right. Fair enough. All in agreement? All right, we'll carry that forward. So we're now up to 10:30 on our schedule. Keeping us right on track. We begin at this point in time to get an environmental, we're going to shift gears to our care coordination effort, and we need a little bit more background and education about where we are in moving into this area. So we've asked others who, outside our perspective, have had their own unique focus and perspective in this arena to come and help us think through this. And I believe we're starting with Wendy. So Wendy is from the National Priorities Partnership, and then we've got Jerry Lamb, who we introduced earlier, who will give us their work related to care coordination, and then finally Alan Levins will give us opportunities for improvement in care coordination. So, Wendy, if you would help launch us into this, we'd appreciate the information, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Frank. I'm really happy to be here today to provide an overview of the ongoing work of the National Priorities Partnership and its effort to inform HHS in the development of the National Quality Strategy. Do you have the slides, Chris? Oh, I've got them. There we go. So now that you've been digging into all of the safety areas, it's time to, I think, kind of reel back a little bit, as Frank said, and really think about the bigger picture. I think it's really great to hear all the details of getting into the safety measures, and now to think about care coordination and think about how this work has evolved over the course of the past several years. I think what's really interesting to listen to you all discuss is how all of the priorities of the National Quality Strategy sort of are intertwined, and so the discussions related to pain I think certainly hit on issues related to care coordination, as well as you've already mentioned, issues related to patient experience and how do you start to tease all of those out. And so, unfortunately, I think the safety area was the easy one, and so getting into the next day and a half should prove very interesting. So I wish you all luck, and my prayers are with you. So just to give you a little bit of the background of the NPP and the work that has gone on there, in 2008, NPP did its initial priority setting work and recognized that care coordination was obviously a significant priority area that needed to be addressed and moved forward. And so the areas that NPP had identified back then were related to, no surprise, care transitions, but particularly how a patient experiences care transitions. And as Rich alluded to, sort of that space in between that is really difficult to get to. Issues of medication safety, which I know you've been discussing as part of your earlier safety work. And then 30-day readmission rates and ED visits, which, interestingly, NPP had also put into its overuse bucket of areas to consider for cost reductions and areas that we really should try to prevent that overuse. Another area that sort of was put into that overuse area was related to polypharmacy, which, you know, can take you back to medication safety, but also is certainly an issue that could and should probably be addressed in the area of care coordination. So in 2010, then, sort of as the ongoing work of the NPP is, we were waiting to see whether there would be any type of national quality strategy that came out of the legislation. NPP worked with individual work groups around the six priority areas to try to take things a little bit further, and there are several people in the room who were part of that and other work groups. We had a palliative care work group as well, which you'll see didn't really make it into officially the national quality strategy, but there are certainly implications of it that made it into the care coordination area. But we had a care coordination work group that really wanted to specifically look at the 30-day readmissions work, and obviously that work continues now. We have an NPP action team that Susan Frampton can speak to this afternoon and the work that we're doing there. But this work group really looked at a lot of different areas and how to start to develop an action plan for reducing readmissions. And one of the areas that it addressed was related to measurement. And there were obviously still many areas around measurement that needed to be addressed. What constitutes how do you start to come to some agreement around the terminology of whether it's an avoidable or preventable or an unplanned readmissions, and what are the implications of that? How do we get to other measurements that really can reflect the value of care coordination and transitional care and what patients experience? And then what are some composite measures of care coordination that are based on NQF's composite measurement evaluation framework? And you'll hear Jerry Lamb will speak to the framework around care coordination this afternoon as well. So there's just, I think, a lot of confounding and confluent thoughts going into this work that we're hoping that you all can sort of help us to solve. This is, you've probably seen this many times, the broader national quality strategy, the three aims of better care, healthy people, healthy communities, and affordable care. And again, just looking through here, I think you recognize the importance of effective communication and care coordination, but how it then obviously ties into all of the other areas. So this is really, really a critical piece of the national quality strategy if we're to get to, better health and better well-being, if we're to prevent causes of mortality, if we're to achieve patient and family-centered care. I think all of this really hinges on this area of care coordination. So when we look at the national quality strategy, the three goals that are in the national quality strategy are actually the three that NPP recommended late last year. And so they were really focused on more of the aspirational goals. So you can imagine that it's tempting to try to get into handoffs of care and specific things related to communication, but NPP really felt this was the opportunity to kind of set the vision. And so, how that gets operationalized, I think, is really where the map comes in. But the three areas that NPP and consequently the National Quality Strategy focused on were improving the quality of care transitions and communications across setting, and that related to certainly the experience of patients as they experience their care transitions and what they feel they gain through that process. Improving quality of life for patients with chronic illness and disability, and this is really where we tried to infuse some of the earlier palliative care work that NPP had done into the NPP and the National Quality Strategy. And so, you know, things that you've been talking about with regard to pain and depression and things of that nature that really get at quality of life, we felt that care coordination was, you know, a place that we could start to set that vision for patients and patient-centered care. And then finally, and probably most vague and nebulous and difficult to reach of all, is the notion of shared accountability. And that's where we see that, you know, the conversation this morning has already emphasized on multiple occasions how we need to get there, but we're not quite there yet, and how do we at least get measures in these different areas that then start to link up and demonstrate some shared accountability and people having sort of a common goal or shared goals around care coordination and really starting to push beyond, you know, even just the walls of hospitals and home care agencies and nursing facilities, but into communities more broadly. So when we look at the measures that were identified for the National Quality Strategy, there were two that were put forward, and NPP looked to HHS had asked for measures that really could give a picture of our health and our healthcare system at a national level. So what could we look to as, you know, sort of proxies of whether we're getting to good communication and care coordination? And this was a really difficult undertaking for NPP, and we looked to measures that were already being nationally reported in the ARC Quality and Disparities Reports, measures that were part of Healthy People 2020 or other public reporting programs, the Compare website, really looked at those things that you could look at a national level. And the things that made it into the National Quality Strategy were two things around care coordination. And certainly I think there's a lot of room for this to be fleshed out more in coming years. But I think this is where the MAP work also can help to inform future iterations of the National Quality Strategy. So I think this is an evolution of a strategy, and certainly one that we're interested in having NPP provide more input on as well. But the two measures that were put forth were the patient-centered medical home for children and adolescents, so good news that we're getting some pediatrics in there, and then the three-item care transition measure, which is Eric Coleman's measure, which we know, you know, we'd like to see not just in hospitals but in other settings. So I'll give you a little bit more detail of some of the things that NPP talked about, and this may help to inform your thinking throughout today and tomorrow. But and this is really sort of to show that we, you know, there are a lot of gaps here, obviously. And so these are the types of things that we're looking to try to move forward and help to sort of track on a national level and really push our health and our healthcare system in the direction of better care, affordable care, and healthy people. So, the experience of care transition. So from the patient's perspective, what was their care like? What was the communication that they received like? Do they know how to manage their conditions? Do they feel confident in managing their conditions? Complete transition records. I think anytime we see complete, we, you know, start to dive into, well, what does complete mean? What are the elements of that? And that's, you know, another topic that I'm sure you guys will start to get into as well. Chronic disease control, this was, again, really pushing at the outcomes. And so whether this is related to the, you know, cardiovascular disease, and the diabetes group met yesterday, certainly care coordination plays into that, whether we're talking about our more vulnerable populations, people with, you know, advanced illness, how do we get at all of those issues. I think pain, quality of life, all of those things kind of are embodied in this thing, which is, you know, aspirational, but I think critical that we start to get there through measurement and through our other drivers. care consistent with end-of-life wishes, again, trying to pull in some of our earlier palliative and end-of-life care, and really getting at what are patients' preferences in all of this, and how do we make sure that we're going through that deliberate process with the patient to identify what, particularly as they get close to end-of-life, but even much more upstream when they start to develop one chronic condition or multiple chronic conditions, getting at their preference. The experience of bereaved family members, this gets into sort of the broader health and wellness of our population as well. Again, care of vulnerable populations, I kind of mentioned that under chronic disease control, but we tend to focus a lot on hospitals. We've seen that through the Partnership for Patients work, which is very hospital-centric, and we want to continue to make sure that other settings are brought into the fold and are sharing in that accountability for caring for patients. Community health outcomes, again, really thinking beyond the hospital walls and the healthcare system in general, and then this notion of shared information and accountability. So a lot of gaps were identified, and, you know, I hope that Jerry's conversation about the NQF framework for care coordination and the more recent work of the NQF steering committee can kind of help to start to fill some of these gaps. But, you know, it's really exciting to start to see the work of the National Priority Partnership and the National Quality Strategy really start to come alive in these discussions about which measures to put forward. So I'll stop there. I think in the interest of time, I don't know if you're going straight to Jerry or...
Yeah, we're going to run through the three presentations, okay, if we could, okay, and then... We'll have a brief dialogue. So, Jerry, I think you're up next. Wendy, thank you so much.
I'm pleased to be here as a liaison for the Care Coordination Steering Committee. This is the second one, and you're going to hear a lot of the same themes that you've been discussing this morning, so I think you really kind of launched into what we're dealing with in moving care coordination, performance measurement, quality improvements forward. I'm going to emphasize some of the things Wendy said, but focus a little bit more on the dialogue that we've had in the steering committees and where we're at in terms of your deliberation on where the strengths and the gaps. Some of the common themes that you're going to hear, let me just move this forward, are the issues related to coming up with good system measures. I think you've heard a lot of phrases this morning. Rich talked about the space in between. Don Casey, who has co-chaired these committees with me, talks about the handshake, that care coordination, by definition, means going between more than one person. So we've got the shared accountability issues. We have the issues of attribution just inherent in care coordination. And we've also referred to it as the glue. It's the connector among all of the providers and the settings, which make it difficult, complex to capture. As Helen talked about this morning, it's also pivotal to talk about the consumer perspective. What I'm going to hit is, emphasizing what Wendy said. We have a lot of gaps. We've made considerable movement. I think that the committee has been in agreement that we are at the beginning phases of capturing care coordination. We don't have measures of several of the domains that I'm going to talk about, and I think, as somebody mentioned this morning, there's real concern that we don't just go for checklist measures of care coordination, because this is so pivotal to the consumer and the family experience. We're building on several NQF committee work in the past. Let me just hit a couple. In 2006, there was the committee that looked at the definition and framework for care coordination. And what you see up there are the five core domains that have really guided much of this work. The definition of the healthcare home, and more recently the medical home, and how that's been defined. The proactive plan of care, and
a lot of discussion recently in terms of one plan of care in which the consumer, family members are involved. Lots of discussion about how that gets translated into HIT communication. I'm sure we'll have more discussion today, how information gets exchanged across multiple systems. In the discussions that we've had, particularly in the first committee, we had dialogue about what is care coordination, what represents measurement of care coordination, and what doesn't. For instance, when you look at a measure of somebody moving across settings, the fact that an appointment was made is only part of the handshake. Okay, and we did not recommend endorsement of those kinds of measures because it didn't capture the important pieces of the process. So as we move forward in this discussion, I think it's absolutely critical to take into account that inherent passing of the baton. And you also notice that transitions or handoffs are one domain. I think we've had, again, lots of discussion that transitional care is a critical component of care coordination, but it is not equivalent. And so that care coordination occurs across providers, within and across settings, and we've really tried to take that into account. We also had the committee in 2010, that endorsed 10 measures of care coordination and endorsed 25 preferred practices. I might add here that we received more than, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, more than 70 measures that went forward, that came to the committee, and of those, 10 were recommended for endorsement for a variety of reasons. It could be that they didn't meet the importance or the scientific merit standards, but it also is that they didn't capture what was care coordination. We got a lot of setting-specific, condition-specific measures that looked at, was an appointment made? And if you look at that report, we clearly specified what we were going to recommend for endorsement that in terms of those kinds of criteria. So long history here, recognition of gaps. As Wendy mentioned, and I think several of you have said, this work also informed many of the other measurement application partnership committees. We also have a task force looking at HIT related to care coordination. So the most recent committee, whose report went to CSAC last week, was to look at issues that limit measurement and quality improvement of care coordination and then to identify and endorse measures. And as Rich mentioned before, we did not get any new measures submitted for this second round. Variety of reasons. Rich mentioned the one before in terms of the accountability attribution issues, as well as the fact that these measures are complex and they take time and resources to test. And Lorelei and Karen, who from NQF worked with us on this committee, also went back to measurement developers to talk about why we weren't getting new measures. And this is something that certainly is going to influence the discussion of gaps. So phase one of this group was an environmental scan to identify measure gaps and a commission paper to look at HIT capabilities. Lots of issues, as you can imagine, related to HIT being able to look at the seamless transfer of information across multiple settings, the consistency, the standardization of that, and that work, of course, is just beginning and a topic of great interest. We also developed a pathway forward to advance the field, not on our list of to-dos, but something that the committee felt very strongly about was setting some recommendations to develop the field to move forward, and I think those will be very helpful to this group as well. So
some of the topics that came up, and very relevant to the earlier discussion, is essential needs for broad-based system measurement that are not limited by condition and setting, more proximal process measures so that there is clearly a link between those process measures of what happens with care coordination and some of the outcomes. And I think that speaks to the discussion here about pain and its proximity to some of the other safety outcomes. So the concern that if, as we look at process measures, that we can in fact support that they are proximal to the achievement of important outcomes. Also discussion of structural measures. The concern that care coordination is a complex, skilled process, and we need to be assured that the people who are in fact accountable for it have the skill sets associated with that. The discussion related to measurement of a shared plan of care, and I think there are people in this group who can speak to the discussions going on in HIT related to having one plan of care that is organized, that everyone has input in, that the consumer has input and agreement, and that it moves from setting across settings and providers. And that measures, as I mentioned before, that understand or acknowledge resource use as well as cost-saving outcomes of care coordination. In phase two, we had 15 maintenance measures that came out of the initial committee, as well as some that have been linked to care coordination and identification of future areas. As I mentioned, we put together a call for measures that spoke to those needs in phase one and received no new measures for a variety of reasons. So the work is cut out for us to really carve out where, what really reflects care coordination, how it links to outcomes. We also reviewed 15 maintenance measures, and that included 12 process, 2 outcomes, have also looked at harmonization of these measures and made recommendations for that. 12 of those 15 maintenance measures were recommended to go forward. 3 were not, based on not meeting the criterion of importance. Issues for consideration, and again, this speaks to the early stage of where we're at with care coordination measures, is the fact that in many of the measures that we have reviewed, that the evidence base has been lacking, and in some cases, we believe that some of the measures were promising and important enough to put them forward for limited time limited measures. As you've looked at some of the safety measures, some of the testing for the care coordination measures are conducted only in one setting with one level of analysis, which becomes very problematic when you look at the nature of care coordination needing to move across levels, settings. I'll probably emphasize that ad nauseum. That is what care coordination is all about, as I'm sure you're aware. The feasibility has been an issue related to the burden of paper record abstraction, thus the interest in HIT and the seamlessness with which the important information can cross systems, the lack of standardized terminology and definitions related to a variety of areas important to care coordination, whether it's med rec, readmissions, and so forth. We've also looked at competing and related measures, and one of our consistent recommendations has been the need for harmonization, similar theme to this morning. And then finally, we did take a fair amount of time in this last committee to look at where do we believe this whole area needs to go and make recommendations. Committee members in this last group felt very strongly that this area of care coordination measurement must sequentially move forward. And so there was a call for measurement maturity, increasing complexity, which in essence means we've got to capture what care coordination is all about. Don's comment about both sides of the handshake, making an appointment is not sufficient. It's kind of what Dana was talking about before. One assessment, one checklist doesn't cut it with care coordination. It's the assessment, the reassessment, making sure that there's a plan in place. Much of this is antecedent to care coordination, but must be in place for effective care coordination. Using some of the new measures to drive practice, and we also identified priorities for future measurement, an emphasis on what is important to the patient. This is an absolutely critical area, and one of the really interesting dialogues in the group, which I imagine happens across NQF, is the discussion of our own experiences. And when the system falls apart, it's because the handshake hasn't been concluded, because coordination, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, and people fall through the cracks. And so a critical experience of this is falling through the cracks. And so the consumer's perspective, the patient and family's perspective, we thought was a priority. Linking patient goals, interventions, and outcomes, because those, that's the glue in care coordination. Continuity, as well as adverse events as markers of poor care coordination. And to the extent possible, having them be proximal to the outcomes that you're considering in safety and quality. We also suggested that we do have 25 preferred practices that we have detailed information that have been endorsed, that we really should use them to take a look at, can they give us insights into where we should go with care coordination measurement, and also go out and find some of these measures. Our sense of things, and perhaps this may be yours as well, is that there is a tremendous amount of care coordination going on out there, and people are using a variety of ways to determine the effectiveness, and very few of those measures are being tested or coming forward to us. A lot of work ahead.
So Wendy and Jerry have really teed up the complexities fabulously. There's so much work, and I appreciate both of you for presenting that. We're going to ask Alan now to bring forward some of the NQF endorsement work that we have to date going forward with care coordination. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. Good morning, everybody. Level set as well, for those of you who weren't at the previous meeting, what the NQF staff did was to try to identify broad topic areas within the broader category of previously for safety and now for care coordination. So what I'm going to be talking about is a little bit of background about research that's already been done to talk about some of these subtopic areas and then tie it into the national quality strategy and some of the points that Wendy and Jerry made. So just to start with the NQF official definition of care coordination, and a couple of the points that struck me when I first saw this were the emphasis on patient-centered approach, as well as considering not just communication between individuals, but communication of information. So making sure there's coordinated transfer of information as well as communication between individuals and coordination of services. I won't spend much time on this because Wendy already talked about the tie-in to the National Quality Strategy and the specific components of the long-term goals, but again, when you see the subtopic areas that staff chose, this will tie in very nicely to these points. So these are the five topic areas, and this is just meant to jumpstart the discussion. Part of what the group will need to do is ensure that we've covered the main topic areas, and if this needs to be fleshed out further, for instance, another category added. But this was just a means to organize the existing measures for discussion. So the first topic we're going to cover is avoidable emissions and readmissions. And again, Wendy sort of highlighted some of the issues, but just to give a little bit more concrete data here, both in the Medicare and Medicaid population, admissions and readmissions are fairly high. Both IOM and ARC have identified that in Medicare beneficiaries, 30-day readmissions occur about 20% of individuals. There was an HCUP or an ARC briefing that's slightly later than what I cited there that I found afterwards that indicated that in Medicaid patients, it's actually closer to Medicare now, so actually closer to 20% rather than the 1 in 10 I cited there. And then across all insured populations, so including commercial populations, it was more about 10%. And then citing a MPP action brief, in terms of avoidable readmissions, which that definition will be discussed later, about 11% of readmissions are estimated to be avoidable. In terms of financial cost, estimates vary, but clearly extremely high cost issue. So again, concerns about what is truly an avoidable readmission. The AHA has issued a position paper indicating that the focus should really be on unplanned readmissions. Clearly, there can be reasons for a patient to be admitted that was planned based on the prior admission, and there can also be admissions that are solely unrelated to the prior admission. So. That's an important point to make. And then there are also certain aspects of patients that we may not be able to get at through readily available data, so particularly things like social support structure or a patient's ability to understand instructions because they're not a native English speaker could certainly factor into how likely someone is to be readmitted, which may not be able to be readily accounted for in a measure. AHA has also pointed out that some studies have indicated an inverse relationship between mortality and readmission, so that reducing readmission rates may not necessarily be associated with a direct impact on reducing deaths. So clearly considering these the above factors, there are potential unintended consequences if the focus is strictly on just reducing readmissions. That said, there are there's clearly the need to try to focus on the issue of admissions and readmissions if they are avoidable. And a recent review by Mathematica that was conducted on the Medicare Coordinated Care demonstration projects found that there were certain approaches that were more commonly used in programs that successfully did reduce readmissions. And so I've listed those there. Some of the common aspects there are really direct interaction with both patients and providers, focusing on communication, and then also systems that are built to handle transitions well and transfer information. So just a little bit more background on avoidable admissions or readmissions. There are many studies that look at potential factors that could affect the rate of admissions and readmissions. Follow-up care, just one study there looking at heart failure patients, but there were a number of studies that really emphasized the importance of timely follow-up. Certain transitional care interventions. I'm going to have a slide about that coming up. And then also AJ cited some individual hospital efforts that really showed some remarkable reductions in readmissions over a relatively short period of time. So this clearly is encouraging that there are opportunities to make changes that can reduce readmission rates. So moving into our next topic area, system infrastructure report support, and this we divided into sort of two subtopics, medical homes and health information technology. I've put up a couple different definitions of the concept of a medical home and its different terminology is used. But one of the best summaries of evidence that I'd seen that was pretty up to date was an ARC systematic review published this year. And what was interesting is one of the first statements in the results section was that more study is needed. So they didn't even wait till the end of the report to put that up front. But basically, the bottom line was that there are some favorable effects, but there's a lot of inconsistency, as you can imagine, as to what is being considered a medical home. And in some cases, it was just having a care coordinator attempting to do more coordination. So at this point, as Eric pointed out, more study, or Mathematica, who conducted the study, pointed out more study is needed. And particularly on not only improvements in coordination, but effects on cost, because at this point, the net message was that there really hasn't been shown to be a cost savings aspect as well. Health information technology, again, just a sort of a definition there from a recent NQF consensus report, as well as MedPAC. And there is increasing evidence. The Health IT Gov website has pointed out a number of areas where health information technology is making advancements in terms of care coordination and improvements in care quality in general. And I just wanted to put this slide up, which I pulled from that site, which shows the uptake of EHR adoption, because that has been raised in a number of cases as a limiting factor of using technology to effectively improve care coordination, is that there just wasn't enough individuals using EHRs. But clearly a lot of the programs that the federal government has instituted and others have greatly increased uptake of EHR usage. So in terms of care transitions, the NQF consensus report defines this as a handoff or a transition between different settings of care. Transitions are very critical. The Joint Commission indicated that at this stage could be responsible for about 35% of sentinel events. The care transitions intervention is a good example to discuss. That's a program by Eric Coleman at the University of Colorado, and I think Wendy had mentioned that, where they showed, they have showed substantial reduction in hospital readmissions and programs in a randomized control trial. And further studies have also showed this is effective in real world applications. And then just the last point about care transitions, it's extremely important to make sure that the patients perspectives and needs are incorporated. Communication can be defined pretty broadly. There's physician-patient communication, communication among providers, communication of information between systems, but there's pretty general agreement that communication is something that needs to be improved. In terms of patient care, and I'm just going to cite a couple of studies that were cited in that last reference, just for some context. So a study of 122 pediatricians showing that no information was sent to the specialist in 49% of referrals, and the specialist only providing information back 55% of the time. Another study showing that among patients who visited a physician in the past few years, 17% reporting that test results were not available at the time of scheduled appointment. And then lastly, a survey of adults with chronic illness or recent acute illness who had been recently hospitalized, and in one-third of those cases, they reported that no follow-up arrangements had been made after discharge. So plenty of opportunities for improvement of communication between all those parties that I've mentioned. And then lastly, care planning. Again, definition from NQF in the recent consensus reports. And in terms of research, the results on the isolated effect of care planning is somewhat limited, because as you can imagine, care planning is generally incorporated as part of other components of care coordination, so patient-centered medical home, care transition. So care planning is an isolated issue, is not as well studied, but I did cite some examples there where the IOM had issued a report recommending that all patients with cancer be have a survivorship care plan, and there was actually some mixed findings there. There were some that indicated that this was effective, but others saying that it really had minimal effect. So I think the bottom line there is, again, sort of considering care planning in the larger context of other components of care coordination. So with that, I will turn it back to...
Great, thank you. So in the interest of the gastronomics that we need to take care of, what I'd like everybody to do is to take a quick bio break, get your lunch, come back to the table, and what we'll do is we'll open up after a couple minutes, we'll open up our dialogue with the presentations we've heard and the framework that we'll then end up walking through. So I believe lunch is ready, so it's right behind us. So let's do that, and then we will have the three presenters here for us to ask questions and to consider the framework as we tee this up. Nancy?
Is there any reason to take public comment before then? I see it's on the agenda, and I just...
Yeah, I'm gonna open up, before we actually jump into the dialogue, I'm going to open up for public comment through the whole morning session, because we had the safety issues and other aspects of this as well. All right? Okay, so let's grab our lunch and then come back. So while we're finishing lunch, we've had a lot of dialogue this morning, beginning with safety, and so if we could, Arnika, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Yes, I'm here.
We're going to open up the lines for public comment, and if we could ask on the phone lines and in the room for public comment on this morning's dialogue.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. At this time, there are no questions.
Great. Thank you so much. And I don't think I see anybody in the room. So we'll close our public comment at this point. And I'll open up dialogue from the group where we are heading. We've got our two presentations from Wendy and from Jerry regarding coordination care, and then Alan outlining some subtopic areas that we'll dig into. So let me open this up for reactions and questions from the group to our two presenters and to Alan. Tom?
Thank you. I think these are all very important topics. What I did not hear, though, was the ability to prioritize. Speaking either from my portion of life where I'm seeing patients, a lot of them are fine. They don't need to have external assistance. They take care of themselves. Or from my function as a health plan medical director, where we do some predictive modeling create assessments as to those people who are more likely than others to have need. So within all of this, do we have some way of creating a prioritization schedule so we're not using a lot of resources unnecessarily?
Excellent. Richard?
Well, my comments are similar. I really appreciate the presentation, and I appreciate your sharing all the hard work that's been done on the committee. Since this is a new area and we don't have a whole lot of measures, I think maybe we have an opportunity to be a little more strategic. And so the question I would ask is, what does success look like? Do we know? When can we say System A is a highly coordinated system? How do we know that? And how do we know when it's not true? And if we know what it looks like, what are the one, two, or three things we really need to know to get there? What do we need to do to get there? So I think it's great we've got 25 preferred practices, and it's great we identified them, but 25 means to me we don't have focus. And if we had one, two, or three high leverage activities, then we would have, you know, three high impact measures maybe. And so rather than saying help us bring forth measures, maybe instead saying here are three areas we really need to measure, can you develop measures in these three areas, and then be a little, would give us a chance to be a little more strategic.
Terry, were you going to react to these? I didn't mean to cut you off.
I wanted to share with you, if you go back to the 2010 report, part of that discussion in the first committee was whether to stay focused on care coordination and general measures of care coordination, or what is typically called the high-risk case management focus, from the vantage point of all patients need care coordination, but there's a subpopulation that needs very intense care coordination. And for the purposes of that committee, we decided not to differentiate them, but did recommend that be a topic for consideration in the future, that it really was critical to have risk identification as well as a more intense intervention for certain subpopulations. So your point's very well taken. It was recommended in 2010, but I don't know that it's been revisited.
Helen?
Thanks. I just want to make one supplemental comment to the great discussion Jared put forward, that a lot of the discussion of this most recent committee was really focused on what are the gaps, not in terms of measures, but the gaps in terms of infrastructure. I think one of the biggest rate-limiting steps that the committee talked about, and we had a paper prepared by David Bates and colleagues, was the lack of interoperability. So to get at some of those system measures, Richard, I think some of the challenges were some of the great measure concepts that, for example, ONC has been thinking about, for example, in the care coordination tiger team that I was on, were so dependent on having information that flowed between different sites that is still a rate-limiting step. And I think one of the questions is, if we're thinking about this measure development space, can we think about development in the EHRs? We hope we'll have de novo development as opposed to thinking about, in our current environment, really thinking more future tense of what those systems, HIT systems that are interoperable, can bring us and develop measures for that new space, rather than kind of being stuck in this paradigm of years and years of asking for measures, none of which are really quite meeting the mark, which I think is predominantly based on infrastructure.
Nancy?
So, first of all, I really appreciated the presentations that were made right before lunch, and they raised in my mind a challenging set of questions around how all of this hung together, because as I think about it, care coordination is an absolutely integral part of providing good care across the continuum, but it's not the only thing. Each of us providers has our own roles that we have to do and do well in order to keep the patient moving towards health or restoration of their health. And admissions, avoidable admissions, are a critical thing to think about, but they're very different in some respects from avoidable readmissions. As we think about this, I think there are a number of topics we have to tease out and then see if all of this comes together in a way that makes sense as we try and bring it back together. And if that's not clear, I'm glad to try and expand on that further, but there's complexity in this.
John?
Reflection on Jerry's presentation, and maybe she has an observation upon my observation. When you were presenting on looking at identifying and prioritizing measure concepts, I was just surprised with, in the area of care coordination, there what was absent from the list was that kind of family of measures of overuse, misuse, efficiency, because it seems like one of the symptoms of poor care coordination is that duplication of services, contraindication of services and diagnoses and diagnostics and treatments. But perhaps that was discussed, or perhaps I missed it from your presentation. Any thoughts?
I think it's one of those areas that was implicit rather than explicit. Some of the discussions were in terms of the impact of or lack of impact of care coordination on duplication, you know, the redundancy of services, the omission of services, and I think that it's another inherent area, but it was not a specific focus, but some of the measures that came forward began to touch that, but we didn't have any really strong ones. Helen, would you add anything to that?
Richard?
Yeah, there's a couple of comments and questions. I think, you know, the work that you guys have done is really great. It's helping move this ball further, and I think that's what this committee and what the National Quality Forum is all about, is to keep the ball rolling. We know that there are problems, but let's keep moving. Two questions. One is, as you know, there's a lot of people who are involved in the care management process, who define care management as something that's part of their domain. And if you look at care management through different people's lenses, there's as many different definitions of care management as there are, you know, providers. And that probably has something to do with why there's so different, many different dimensions of care management. So I guess one question I would have is given the role of non-medical providers in the care management process, particularly thinking of people with disabilities and thinking of people who are actively involved in long-term care and care of frail elders, to what degree have spokespersons from those particular settings been involved in kind of helping shape this kind of communication exchange-oriented kind of approach to care management? And then the second question I have is, to what degree has there been discussion about continuity of care as something different than coordination of care, in the sense that coordination of care here has a heavy definition on handoffs in communication? And there's also a lot of people who serve the same people at the same time, whether there's a handoff or not, that affects, you know, outcomes because of the multidimensional aspect of any given person's problem. And so interested in what degree, you know, your deliberations have looked at those two issues.
Did you have any?
Start, and perhaps, you know, Wendy, Helen, you can add. Rich, those were parts of the discussion, and particularly not only in the care coordination committees, the steering committees, but in the measurement application partnership. I sit on the post-acute, and lots of discussion about the fact for individuals and families with chronic illnesses, they are the ones doing the majority of the care coordination, not healthcare professionals. And thus the priority in the area of identifying what is important to those family members, because we're not capturing very much of that at all. So huge gap from the experience of, you know, the family member who is trying to keep everything knit together and keep everything on track. And very few of our measures that came forward or the ones we reviewed begin to touch that. Continuity of care, I think, indirectly I spoke to in that so many people focus on transitions in care and handoffs, obviously because it's a vulnerable time in the continuum, but it's not all of care coordination. And that speaks to the issue of while we need to hit outcomes are absolutely essential here, but in care coordination, one of the things to think about is how much do we need good process measures because it is so complicated. And there are a lot of folks out there that believe that they are doing care coordination when they're not. And there are a lot of people doing it that they may not even know that they're doing it or not be acknowledged for it. So it's an interesting balance of, in the case of care coordination, as we look at the family of measures, is there a need for a different balance of structure, process, and outcome just to keep the field moving? Because I think the data, as Alan was showing, is that if you don't put the right interventions in place, you're not likely to hit the safety outcomes that you were talking about.
Wendy, did you have?
The only thing that I would add to that is that as NPP talked about the area of readmissions, it really wanted to emphasize a focus on not just readmissions, but Nancy, as you said, admissions, and that's a very different thing. And again, getting out past the healthcare system and into the communities, and this was something that came up when we had our work group meeting around care coordination, too, that was particularly important for pediatrics. I think, Richard, you may have brought this up, was really, you know, readmission. If we're just focused on readmissions, it's not cutting it. And so how do we, by emphasizing, you know, the avoidable admissions, kind of start to move in that direction as well?
Aparna?
So a couple of quick comments. I wanted to concur with the concepts that John put on the table in terms of looking at resource use and duplication and appropriate testing and so forth. Then the other question I have was, I'm heartened to see avoidable admissions and readmissions on that list, but I was also wondering if there was a discussion around avoiding potential ER visits, for example, and looking at that as well in terms of care coordination.
So we actually had a measure submitted on potentially avoidable ED visits, I think the last round in care coordination, and it was not found to be reliable or valid yet. So I think this is one of those areas where it's especially difficult to use claims-based algorithms to determine whether an ED visit was urgent or not. So we would love to see some of that work. I don't know if John has any updates. I know there was John Bonnet may have an update. There was some work ongoing at ARC by Ryan Mutter to take some of the community and the preventative hospital prevention quality indicators and consider a way to create those for ED, and I don't know if there's any update on that yet, John.
So Aparna, we either hold that as a new bullet point or we put it under admissions and readmissions as a subtopic. Either, is that okay? Okay.
Frank, this is also, as Matt goes into looking at the affordable care piece later, one of the goals around that is around sort of reducing overuse, and NPP had proposed earlier on, including the avoidable ED visits, and that kind of got put in that affordable care bucket for this government. So.
Great, thanks. Randy?
Thank you. I thank you. This looks like some great work, but I would say that I think that this is our greatest opportunity, care coordination, particularly in the Medicare population, for impact at what I would call the intersection of quality and cost. And there is tremendous opportunity, and it's largely a population not with single conditions but with multiple concurrent conditions and psychosocial barriers. In that context, I think I think the avoidable admissions and readmissions are particularly valuable measures because this represents an outcomes measure for care coordination that is not condition specific, and I think that also rather sensitive to this. And again, avoidable admissions is likewise a measure of quality and cost both. In that context, I also I've made this point before. Avoidable readmissions are a subset, really, of avoidable admissions, and the two are, in fact, related. If one is doing a really good job on avoidable admissions, if you're going to measure readmissions as a percentage, that puts you at a disadvantage. And for that reason, I think there is real value in measuring readmissions as an absolute number as opposed to a percentage. And I have made this point before. In fact, you quoted Naylor, 2011, as part of the presentation. I would point out we made that point in that particular paper also. I recognize that would be almost impossible to apply that measure in that context to a hospital, because you need to apply it to a population. But this measure is also being used with health plans, where it can be applied to a population, and it could be more useful when done in that way. And I think we should look at whether in some context this would be more valuable, looking at it as an absolute number as a population-based measure.
Great, thanks, Rhonda.
Well, I originally put my card up because I had some questions about the avoidable admissions. I wasn't quite clear why the definition was restricted to just unplanned readmissions due to factors related to the first admission, which implies it's always a readmission and not an avoidable admission. Like some of the measures that you have really imply, for example, with diabetes, if someone has ketoacidosis, that should have been something that was manageable in a non-hospital setting prior to the patient getting to that point. So I was just wondering why the definition, I think, Kevin, I think you put up, right?
Right, I mean, that was the definition from the NQF consensus committee, so I don't know if someone can speak to that.
This was the readmission definition. Do we have this?
Yep. I thought you were referring to a definition. This actually is just a statement from American Hospital Association indicating that there should be a focus on the unplanned admissions, because you can have unplanned and planned, and then within each of those, whether it's related or unrelated. So within those four buckets, we're just emphasizing that the focus should be on the unplanned related admissions.
I'm sorry to ask these questions, but in behavioral health, this is a very, very important issue, but it's very hard to define. So I was really trying to understand how does the unplanned admission get defined on the medical side. And, again, I was looking at some of the measures there, and it looked like there is I don't know if it's by consensus or if it's by evidence, that certain conditions like diabetes, and I mentioned ketoacidosis, maybe there is a standard of care that assumes that should be something that generally should be managed in an ambulatory setting. So therefore, someone ends up in the hospital. That means that it was an indication that they were not managed well on an outpatient basis. Is that a correct assumption? And is that the direction that medical is going in terms of defining avoidable admissions? No. Okay.
Nancy?
Well, since this is a statement from AHA, let me just be clear. We were speaking about readmissions, not original admissions, because the readmissions was the issue du jour. And what we were saying was when you're trying to look at what constitutes an avoidable readmission, you ought to look at things that aren't planned, because if you're there in the first place and they plan to bring you back to the hospital to treat something, then that represents good care generally. And the ones that are directly related to the original reason you were there, as opposed to those that are unrelated and might be the result of trauma or some other condition that emerges post-discharge. So that was the focus we were trying to bring to it. Readmissions that are unplanned and related are the ones where you should be focusing your attention when you're looking to try and reduce avoidable readmissions. We weren't commenting on admissions to begin with.
So I'll hold the rest of my questions on this thing.
Anne-Marie?
I have another question, but just in answer to that, I do believe that many of the plans and some of the indicators are moving towards the concept that if you have so many diabetics in your population, you should only have so many admissions for things like ketoacidosis. So they are looking at that as an avoidable admission over a percentage of a population. So that's definitely out there is what people are looking at. You know, so they are looking at avoidable admissions in and of themselves, not just related to readmissions. But I had a question on community-based measures and how you see community health measures, which are often more larger in scope, because you mentioned those as one, and how you see those interacting with many of the measures we look at, which are really care-specific, and we do know that a lot of even the care we provide can have sometimes minimal effects on big community populations. So I was just wondering how you're putting the community health measures in, and is there any priority on looking at some of what we want to emphasize being ones that might move that needle in community health, if you know what I mean?
Is this for Jerry?
Yeah,
or
whoever
or
spoken
or
about
Wendy?
The community, yeah. I think when you, as
yeah,
you
well,
mentioned.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, again, NPP is looking sort of towards that ideal state and where we can start to think beyond the walls of the hospital and where there is potential for measurement that we should start moving in that direction. I don't know that we had any clear examples of, you know, other than sort of starting to look at some of the medical home models and things like that where you're starting to look at the, you know, some non-healthcare focused and really, you know, sort of starting to connect to the resources that are available in the community. But we looked for things certainly at the national level and had a hard time with identifying any particular measures, but certainly something to continue to look towards as we move down this path, recognizing the impact that all of those issues have on coordination and admissions.
Jane?
Just one comment on the infrastructure support. To Rhonda's point, the idea of avoiding a hospital admission for care that could be provided at a lower level if the infrastructure were there in terms of whether it be a SNF or even care that could be delivered at home, coordinated through care coordination, I think would be something to think about as well.
Andrea?
You know, I think the bullets that were on one of those slides, if you just flashed through a minute ago quickly around the issue about the relationship between mortality and readmissions is important, and we may want to think about that as we think about balancing measures and little grouplets of measures. Where I used to work, one of our hospitals was a large academic medical center, and the mortality metric was always better than expected, and the readmission metrics were always worse than expected. And, you know, we sort of half-joked knowing that there was plenty of room to be improved on readmissions, but, you know, we kept them alive so you could readmit them, right? So the easiest way to not readmit people is to not have them leave your hospital in some way, shape, or form. So I do think that those metrics, for better or for worse, deserve some pairing and some thinking about in conjunction. And there may be others that I'm not even able to think outside the box adequately around, but that go with those things. So.
Great. Richard?
Now, one of these last comments made me just realize we talk about care coordination, but we never talk about health coordination. And we had a pretty large discussion yesterday at the Diabetes and Cardiovascular Task Force about looking at primary prevention as opposed to disease management. So, sure, you can manage hemoglobin A1C, but isn't it better to reduce the risk factors, reduce obesity in the community? And so at some level, at some point, we have to start thinking about health coordination. I don't know who's on whose to-do list that's going to fall. But
I think it's the mayor of New York City. He is. No more large sodas. Tom?
Yeah, Richard, we call that well-being. and there's things that can be done there. But the point I wanted to make was we've got balances. We've talked about this. But it's the paternalism that we can have by saying everybody will have a degree of care coordination and it's going to be looked this way so we can measure it and it can be done. But on the other hand, we're talking about individuals who have their own wishes, their own needs, and a lot of my patients from the Hills say, I don't want anybody messing with me. I'm going to take care of myself. That has to be built into that balance.
So are you stating we ought to have a patient preference bullet?
Thank you. You said it a lot faster than I did.
Okay. David?
So on this point of the inverse relationship between mortality and readmissions, that seems very logical to me. If a patient needs to be readmitted, let's hope they get readmitted and don't die. I mean, I'm not sure what the evidence was, but if that's what it's saying, it's pretty logical. No one's saying these patients shouldn't be admitted when they need to be. I think the point here is that we are hoping that better care coordination will lead to less need for readmission and keep people alive.
Well, again, great discussion. I'll take my chair's hat off and throw one more comment into the pool. And to me, this whole area of care coordination is very chronic care focused, which is very important and critical, and I recognize that. But I don't think there's a good enough crosswalk to what's happening in the acute care arena and care coordination. From the world of surgery, we look at this differently, and to me, this is a bit of a square peg trying to fit into the round hole. We don't have, our delivery system is not wired to do care coordination for the most part. So we're trying to create measures that are trying to force a structural change. The ideal care coordination in the surgical setting is trauma care. And we have a national trauma care system that begins at the point of care. And the care coordination goes all the way out to the individual EMT on the scene. And it even has a telephone number associated with, you know, how you call for the emergency, who gets out there, all the way through the trauma care to the point of discharge from the hospital. There are metrics that measure every step of that care. And when the trauma system gets credentialed, as it's credentialed, as a level 1, 2, 3, or 4 trauma center, they have to hit rigid criteria that demonstrate they've connected all those pieces. That's coordinated trauma care. We don't do that in CHF, and we don't have a care plan meeting. The trauma care team videos every trauma in a level 1 trauma center and has to review it in 24 hours to see where were the missed opportunities. And the trauma care team reviewing it includes the ambulance drivers, it includes the EMT, it's every nurse, it's the hospital administrator. So they're looking at what happened every step of the way. We don't do that in these other complex areas that we're very deeply worried about. Where's the planning meeting with the primary care base and the cardiologist who's ever managing CHF jointly? We don't call for it in the way we deliver care. We ask each one of them to go to their respective corners and to treat patients alone in isolation and communicate to each other. We never put them in the same room and have a dialogue. The other example for me is in cancer care, where there are various levels of coordination of care in tumor registries. There are hospitals in the country today where you can go into the hospital, the patient will be seen in a cancer center by all the multidisciplinary teams, and they, within 24 hours, form a cancer treatment protocol that they give the patient. They say, this is your care plan for the next 18 months. This is what we're doing. So if we vary from this, let us know, and we have to justify why we moved off the dime, what we're doing. There are other aspects of cancer care where it's traditional, the surgeons refer to patients, the oncologist is referred to the same patient, the radiation therapist is referred to the same patient, but they never sit in the same room and have a dialogue. So to me, care coordination is putting the team taking care of the patient in the same room, setting targets and saying we're hitting it. And I think we're trying to do that across
the wrong structure, and we're trying to use measurement to do it. And that confuses me. If we're trying to improve CHF, then why aren't we putting the CHF doctors who've got to take care of a population in the same room and talking about it? I don't get that. So that's the square peg round hole for me. Rhonda?
One of the other things with care coordination, I'm just going to throw this out for consideration, particularly under communication. When I looked through some of the measures, they were certainly around communication between providers, that hospitals, outpatients, so forth. But one of the things I think is missing is that there's another source of information that isn't involved that isn't involved in the measures, and that are health plans. Health plans have a real wealth of information on patients based on claims. They have events, at least, and if they have the ability to coordinate that, and particularly if they have the medical, behavioral, and pharmacy, a lot of rich information is there, at least in an acute setting where you may need to know what medications that patient was taking, and you don't, the patient may not be able to tell you, or how many hospitalizations they've had in the past and what were the diagnoses. That kind of information is covered under HIPAA, but it is not necessarily part of your coordination or your communication measure.
One last comment on this, Richard, and then we need to move on.
I just wanted to say I think you were making my comment more concrete, which is if we think this is the important focus, right, the coordination of the team and when they meet and how many times they review, then we should be measuring that. Instead, we measure where the lamp light is, and we look at readmissions because they're there, but we never step back and say, what are the levers that we need to push?
Yep. Well, thank you for that comment. So, again, very rich discussion. Now we have to get into the weeds, and we got to pick measures on these groups. So you have done the homework. As we had done in our last grouping, and we're going to start with, I think, where are we, Lindsay? Shared accountability. Tom is going to line us up first here in framing the shared accountability related to avoidable admissions and readmissions. And then we'll move in from there into an orderly discussion of a more holistic perspective about this. Tom?
Thank you, Frank, and I agree with you. This is great discussion for the remaining agenda items that we have this afternoon and tomorrow in order to develop this care coordination family of related measures to add to our safety family of related measures. And I wanted to take this opportunity as we're moving into the first of the specific care coordination topics, which is avoidable admissions and readmissions, to add a little bit more context and maybe sharpen up our task even a little bit more beyond the task that we've been about, which is creating this family of related measures. So in terms of this measurement topic or subtopic, the avoidable admissions and readmissions, there's been a recent endorsement project around a hospital wide all-cause readmission measure. I know some of you have followed this very closely, so this won't be any news, but I suspect that a few of you at least wouldn't know that that this process had been ongoing. And during the course of that endorsement process, there was a lot of discussion about measured use and implementation issues along the lines of what Richard had raised previously, that during endorsement sometimes these issues around use and implementation come up. And the response is endorsement is really about looking at the properties of individual measures. But the MAP's role is to look at the way measures would be used, implemented in specific programs as part of larger sets of measures. So when this issue of the endorsement and appeal of the endorsement of the hospital-wide all-cause readmission measure came to the board at its June 25th call, before the board made its final decision to uphold the endorsement of that measure, The board voted unanimously to make a resolution about the MAPS role in working through how readmission measures should be implemented. And the gist of the resolution is that the NQF board requested MAP to convene a special session to develop a strategy for implementing care coordination and readmission measures in programs and across settings that have shared accountability to reduce readmissions. So MAP has been requested by the NQF board to convene a special session on this topic of readmission measures, and we will be doing that in conjunction with the August 14th and 15th MAP coordinating committee meeting. So we'll take a half day on the morning of August 15th to have a special session at the coordinating committee level on the use and implementation of readmission measures. So in setting that up, we will use, again, the National Quality Strategy and the work of the National Priorities Partnership as part of the background. We'll also have a policy-level discussion about implementation of readmission measures from the standpoint of the various stakeholders who sit on the coordinating committee. We'll have a presentation from the hospital health system perspective, ambulatory perspective, post-acute, long-term care, community health plan, consumer, so on, and we're in the process of getting that set up. We'll also be asking CMS and ONC, our MAP representatives, Patrick Conway from CMS and Kevin Larson from ONC, to also share with the group their current thinking about readmission measures for federal programs and about what is needed when, because I think part of MAP's role in this is to help think through the phasing of what we would recommend be used when in terms of these particular programs. And then, of course, everything that we're doing, whether it's the discussion that we're having here today or the coordinating committee discussion, is to set policy around how MAP will make its pre-rulemaking decisions at the end of the year. So we know we're going to get questions from HHS in the form of this list of measures under consideration, just like we did last year, of what measures are the best measures for specific programs for 2013 rulemaking. And in order to be prepared for that, these are the kinds of discussions we need to be having. That's the role of families generally, but more specifically here, we've also been asked to be prepared to have this special session of the coordinating committee on the morning of August 15th. So in order to do that, we want to have a similar kind of setup here for the avoidable admission and readmission discussion, because Frank is going to need to take this group's conclusions about the use and implementation of readmissions measures in the context of the care coordination family to the coordinating committee on August 15th. So what we're going to do now to help prepare for this special session and to help prepare Frank for what he's going to take to the coordinating committee special session is have a discussion about the specific work that MPP has been doing in readmissions, as well as have some of you all who represent various stakeholder interests raise your top three or so things that you would want to raise for this group to consider as we get into the available admissions and readmission measures about their use and implementation, and to inform how we would set up then that special session at the coordinating committee level. So I hope that's useful context for our next couple of hours of discussion.
You keep referring to me, Tom. All right. Well, so we have a lineup that we're going to follow in an order and try and walk through a whole host of experts on different perspectives related to this. And we're beginning with the chair of the NPP's Admissions Readmission Action Team, Susan Frampton. So, Susan, if we could pass this to you.
Thank you. I certainly hope that some of what I have to share today is helpful and not just even more confusing
given the difficult task that this group has before them. Also wanted to thank Wendy and Jerry and Alan. They did a great job, I think, of raising some of both the challenges and the opportunities that we have before us in enhancing care coordination. And certainly one of the themes that came out was that need for shared accountability, and Frank, I agree with you that that's so very important, and yet we have a system that really doesn't yet connect all of these different places in which we find transitions occurring and which we need care coordination to happen. The other perspective I always like to bring up is that of the patients and the families and their perspectives on what good care coordination means, because they have a very practical viewpoint, and it's one that we always have to remind ourselves of. And often as I sit in these meetings, I try to put on the lens of my mom or my dad. You know, my mom had a stroke 2 years ago, and they are still living that experience of an admission, of an unnecessary readmission, of trying to manage their care across two different states and five different physicians, and it sometimes feels very overwhelming. So I think we got a sense of that from the conversation. However, it's a really important task. So keeping that patient-family perspective in mind, I actually think, is one of the foundational elements of HHS's partnership for patients, and I really want to commend them for attempting to do that, to keep that front and center. As we all know, this partnership was launched last April under the umbrella of the National Quality Strategy, and one of those primary goals was to reduce admissions by 20% by 2013, so still a lofty goal. Last year, HHS requested that NQF engage the National Priorities Partnership to help to propel the Partnership for Patients in its initiatives, and one of the things that we did in response to that was to pull together a readmissions reduction task force, and we've been meeting over the last 7 months, working very hard to come up with some practical strategies and tactics to help to be successful in this goal. And this is what we've come up with to date in terms of our readmissions action pathway. And as you can see, one of the overarching strategies and focuses that we've come up with is the need to promote shared accountability across care settings. But to do that in a way that is very much cognizant of patient and family preferences. And that was certainly something that came out in conversation earlier in the day, making sure that that patient and family perspective is built into whatever strategies or initiatives we undertake. So that is a major focus, that promotion of shared accountability. Our overarching strategy is looking at the implementation of effective care delivery models and approaches. And one of the things that we found in our ongoing work is that there's really an amazing amount of rich work being done in the field, a number of very successful models and approaches that are being used. And on our most recent action team call, we had a couple of guests, one of them being Jerry Lamb, who shared with our group a couple of very successful models. Jerry talked about Interact2, which is a patient-centered model with demonstrated results to reduce avoidable admissions from nursing homes. And again, that's also been one of our primary areas of focus in this action team. Not that we are ignoring the acute care sector, but Partnership for Patients is doing a great job through the HENS focusing on acute care. We wanted to make sure that our action team looked beyond just acute care to long-term care, home care, and community care settings as well. Another model that was discussed at our latest meeting was the New York VNA SPARC model, and this is a community and home-based care management approach for high-risk patients that's had a great deal of success coordinating caregiver self-management of complex cases. So there are some very successful approaches out there. One of our team's goals again, has been how do we help them to scale this up? How do we help to disseminate this more widely and thereby improve adoption of some of these practices? And our sense is through that work, we'll be able to reduce admissions by the 20% that we've set as a goal. And then our second goal that has developed over time is to increase the uptake of these patient-centered team-based care delivery models by 50% across all settings. So we all have very lofty goals that we've set. We have three primary strategies that are listed on this slide that describe our approaches as well, including analyzing